Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/incontextreport, and our website is incontextreport.com. Hello, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Cantavero.
Hey, guys.
In today's show, we'll begin with a report on recent important military and geopolitical developments in the world. Then we'll turn our attention to a discussion of three issues that will help you put these developments in proper perspective. First, we'll consider the continuing importance of conventional weaponry in today's battlefield. Second, we'll look at the critical role that Europe will play in the renewed rivalry between the United States and Russia. And last, we'll discuss Western intervention in Russia in its civil war in the early 20th century, an event critical to an understanding of Russia's attitude towards the West today. Marchand, we need to talk about recent developments in the ongoing crisis in the Ukraine, but first I'd like to get your thoughts on the latest developments in Syria. Since about 2010, the United States has been attempting to overthrow the Syrian government, which is allied with Russia and Iran, by fomenting and supporting an armed insurrection. Prominent among the insurgents are Islamist fighters brought to Syria by U.S. allies Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Last year, it appeared that the insurgency was being defeated by Syrian President Assad with help from Russia and Iran. And President Obama balked at rescuing the insurgency with U.S. forces out of fear of a direct confrontation with Russia. Now it appears that the United States is again turning up the heat in Syria. What's going on there?
Well, the first thing we have to remember is that the confrontation in Syria is an extension of the global confrontation we are having with Russia. Same as what's going on in the Ukraine is just a symptom of what of the conflict we've had with Russia really since the Cold War. The Cold War just took a hiatus. So because the Russians are ramping up their intervention in the east of Ukraine, U.S. strategists have decided that it would be wise to ramp up pressure on the Russians in Syria, try to distract them. Also, maybe hoping that while the Russians are preoccupied in the Ukraine, we can take this opportunity to topple Bashar al-Assad. Just, I believe it was on the 20th of April, DEBCA filed, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, announced that the United States, mind you, I would like to point out that the American people were never consulted on this. The United States decided to send to the Syrian rebels TOW anti-tank missiles. In addition to that, on the 22nd of April, DEBCA file also published an article saying that the United States had sent to Syrian rebels SA-16 surface-to-air missile systems. Now, the significance of this is that these are man-portable surface-to-air missile systems. The rebels, many of whom are connected to al-Qaeda, in the case of some like the al-Nusra Front, openly connected to al-Qaeda, others loosely connected to al-Qaeda. Regardless, we are giving terrorists, al-Qaeda terrorists, surface-to-air missile systems. Presumably, not all these will be used against the Syrian army. Some may, in the long term, be used against the American people. But that's long term.
With respect to the jihadist fighting and this insurgency movement, a global research recently reported that Ibrahim Ben Shakarin, who is a Moroccan who spent more than 3 years in Guantanamo Bay, the detention facility, was released to Moroccan authorities, and he's since joined the insurgency, leading a jihadist group there in Syria, and he was just killed. So how we got from Guantanamo Bay to leading an insurgency group in Syria, I don't know, but it's very interesting.
It's completely lunatic when you think about it, but most of the leaders, especially of organizations such as the al-Nusra Front, are either had been detainees at Guantanamo, detainees in U.S. Detention facilities elsewhere in the world, known connections, in some cases personally, to Osama bin Laden, or to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the new head of al-Qaeda. We make no secret of it. It's a well-known fact. We just choose not to think about it. But the fact is, the same people who presumably blew up the World Trade Center and the American Embassy in Kenya and whatnot and been trying to kill Americans and been public enemy number one now are okay because they're enemies of the Russians.
Now let's move on to the Ukraine, which again involves the United States and Russia. And first, let me give a little background information again for our viewers and our listeners. The Ukraine lies on Russia's western border and has long historical ties to Russia, and until 1991 was a republic within the Soviet Union. Since the end of the Cold War, the U.S.-led military alliance, NATO, has dramatically expanded and now includes virtually all of Eastern Europe, with the notable exception of the Ukraine. In February of this year, the pro-Russian elected president of the Ukraine was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup in anticipation of Ukraine's move into the Western alliance. Soon after the coup, Crimea, an ethnically Russian part of Ukraine located on a strategically important peninsula in the Black Sea, voted to secede from the Ukraine and join with Russia. Additionally, an uprising against the new pro-Western Ukraine government has broken out in heavily Russian eastern Ukraine. Marshawn, can you tell us what's happening on the ground now in Ukraine?
Well, in eastern Ukraine, the ethnic Russians have risen up and they said they don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. And elements, most significantly, elements of the Ukrainian army and Ukrainian security services have defected. Now, the most important thing is that the U.S. media and politicians have expressed outrage that the Ukrainian government has not been able to crack down on the pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine. And there's been a lot of speculation that there are Russian troops on the ground. Well, I'm sure there are FSB, successor the KGB, FSB and GRU military intelligence agents on the ground in eastern Ukraine. The Russians would be fools not to have them in eastern Ukraine. I doubt that there's Russian army there. In fact, the way they've gotten these uniforms and all these troops has been because large elements of the Ukrainian army have defected. Elite Ukrainian forces, most notably actually members of the Berkut, the elite counterterrorism police units that were all loyal to Yanukovych. We forget that when the new government came into power, they threatened to prosecute all of the members of Berkut. So you had all the elite forces of the Ukrainian police force and all the elite forces of the Ukrainian army defecting and joining the protesters. Another element has been that a lot of the troops from this region have refused to take part in counterterrorism operations. In some cases, as of the 20th of April, there was a very good article in the Associated Press talking about how the Ukrainian troops surrendered the bolts of their rifles. They didn't defect to the protesters' side, but they demonstrated they weren't willing to open fire. So one thing you're seeing in this escalating situation is that the pro-Russian forces are gaining a lot of momentum. They're gaining a lot of legitimacy because nobody's been able to suppress them. Nobody's been able to use whether political force or military force to suppress them, not the United States and not the Ukrainian government.
As I understand it, several of the cities have basically been taken over by secessionists, and they formed something called the Donetsk Republic. And we're talking about nine cities or so that are now effectively in the hands of the, we might say, the Ukrainian rebels.
Actually, as of April 23rd, Fox News reported that it was 12 cities. It had become 12 cities. They formed the Donetsk People's Republic, and largely they identify with the Soviet era. So they're very strongly dominated by the Communist Party. They're also known as the Donetsk Soviet. They pretty much ring the east of Ukraine from the Black Sea, just a little bit past Sevastopol, all the way up the east of the Ukraine.
So if you were going
Sevastopol and the Crimea.
If you were to go into, say, Donetsk or one of these other cities, would you find then a secessionist government functioning? And if so, where would the army of the central Ukrainian government be? Not in the city, or where are they?
Right now, the army of the central Ukrainian government is outside the cities. The Ukrainian army did try to send their troops into the cities, but that floundered very, very badly because, again, the troops were blocked by protesters. Again, in some cases they defected and surrendered their tanks. In other cases, they defected and surrendered their weapons. In some cases, they just surrendered their weapons. And, they have no will to fight. So the Ukrainian army is set up outside of these cities, but they're not going into the cities. And that's making the Ukrainian government appear very weak and very inept.
Is the Ukrainian government afraid that if it moves in force into these cities that it'll provoke a Russian invasion?
Very possibly. That's also the reason why they're not using artillery to drive these people out. They're not starving them.
And of course, they seem to be influenced by U.S. objectives, because I understand the head of the CIA, John Brennan, was in the Ukraine before the Ukrainian government decided to move on these cities. Were they?
Absolutely. Well, the U.S.
Yes.
The U.S. has been very, very involved in the events in Ukraine. I mean, again, we were the ones putting the pressure on the Ukrainian government saying you have to crack down. I mean, just the Friday before the Ukrainian army began to move into eastern Ukraine, Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the Prime Minister of Ukraine, the interim prime minister, was beginning negotiations with the Donetsk People's Republic for autonomy. And then immediately afterwards, Brennan flies, the head of the CIA flies to Kiev, and suddenly the Ukrainian government says, we're not going to compromise. Because let's not forget, the United States and the EU hold the purse strings to the Kiev government. So if the United States and the EU decide to, they can leave the Ukrainian government bankrupt. So the Ukrainian government is, for lack of a better term, at the mercy of the EU and NATO.
So I certainly think
the EU and NATO are operating everything behind the scenes.
So to look at from a military standpoint, the Russians are in the Crimea, no? They may have special forces or KGB people in eastern Ukraine. We don't know how many troops they have on the border. The United States put out a film showing that, or photograph showing masses of Russian troops, and then the Russians pointed out the film was from six months ago, so we're not really sure what's going on the border.
Those aren't our troops. Those are old troops.
So they could have been doing an exercise there 6 months ago. Who knows? Maybe they are able to move troops into Ukraine very quickly anyway. What is NATO doing in response? There's some talk of exercises in Poland and Estonia. How's NATO responding?
As of April 23rd, the first U.S. troops from the 173rd Airborne, about 150 soldiers, landed in Poland for training exercises. Now, these 150 troops are stationed out of Vicenza, Italy. So we were just sort of moving an airborne unit already in Europe into Poland. But there's a plan to move an additional 450 troops into the Baltic states on a regular rotational basis. The theory, and I want to emphasize this very crucially, if the Russians cross the border with 40,000 troops, those 600 Americans altogether would be nothing more than a speed bump. But yes, the reason why the U.S. is putting 150 troops is because if the Russians bomb or invade Poland or Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and they kill or injure an American, they run the risk of sparking a war with the United States, and they wouldn't want that. So basically what the United States is banking on is Russia's fear of a conflict with the United States. I figure if we put troops there, the Russians wouldn't dare do anything because they'd be too afraid of killing an American.
So that may or may not be a miscalculation. If you're sitting in Putin's chair, what's your objective? You want to end this encirclement by NATO, obviously. Ukraine is historically tied to you, so that can't be allowed to fall the way Syria couldn't fall to the United States and NATO. How do you figure you're going to hold on to the Ukraine? Would a partition of the country, do you think, be satisfactory to the Russians, with the eastern Ukraine going to sort of in the Russian orbit?
Putin's a student of history. He is a student of history, as is also the leader of China, which I'd like to point out. The Russians know that the United States will not let the Ukraine be partitioned. The United States and NATO will not allow the Ukraine to be partitioned. So Russia knows that this is eventually going to lead to a clash of empires. Unless, of course, the United States and NATO get too scared and back down, this will lead to a clash of empires, as it has historically, as it did when the Austro-Hungarians invaded Serbia. And the other fact to remember, too, is the Russians are moving in concert with the Chinese. The Chinese, in an article actually published April 22nd, in Bloomberg, China is ramping up its armed forces because it's been noted by U.S. intelligence officials that China is having a massive military buildup. So if Russia moves in the West, China is going to move in the East because China has a lot that it wants from the United States and its Far Eastern allies. Putin knows he holds all the cards. He knows that at the end of the day, military conflict comes, he'll turn off the lights in Western Europe and then see how long the Western Europeans want to fight a war in the dark. At the same time, he knows he will not be fighting the U.S. alone, because in the Far East, he has his allies, China and North Korea. And in Latin America, he has a plethora of allies, not to mention Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia. So really, it's the United States. His long-term goal is to hem in the United States, push the United States into our tiny corner of the world.
Is there a shift going on? What's going on with the other BRIC countries that were formerly considered neutral or American allies?
All of the BRICS countries are still standing behind Russia. They have not signed on to sanctions. India, China, Brazil, South Africa, none of these countries have signed on to sanctions against Russia. And they're the world's emerging wielding economic powers. We no longer, as the United States, wield the economic power, at least over Russia, to squeeze them with our own sanctions. The Europeans wouldn't dare sanction them. So the most important factor is that you're seeing a new Warsaw Pact develop, and that is India, China, South Africa, and Brazil. And to include countries as well, like Venezuela. Venezuela is a major ally and trading partner of the Russians. And so what we're seeing is that the BRICS countries and the other new Warsaw Pact countries, as I like to call them, are still very strongly tied to Russia, and they show no signs of deviating from their support for Russia.
So we're going to have to watch very carefully the development of this Ukrainian situation, not just for what it means for Eastern Europe, but for the whole global picture, the whole confrontation between the United States as the hegemon and its new challengers, the resurgent Russia and ever increasingly powerful China. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch the show at youtube.com/In Context Report. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Hello, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Cantavero. Marchand, if the crisis in the Ukraine were to lead to a war between Russia and NATO, which would be more important, do you think? The new high-tech weapons like unmanned drones or traditional forces like infantry and armor?
Well, I think the first thing is that technology has its role and drones have its role. But just as massed infantry assaults are not useful in the modern war, so too is an over-reliance on technology. One of the things that we have to understand is Eastern Europe, in the words of Colonel Slate, Eastern Europe is tank country. It is flat, it is very open, and it's ideal for tanks and large armies. And the problem with drones is that while they work really well when you're fighting insurgents who don't have anti-aircraft guns, it's going to be a lot more difficult when you're fighting an army that possesses radar, anti-aircraft guns, or soldiers that know how to shoot straight. Because let's not forget, when we're fighting the Taliban, they're not exactly professional soldiers. It's technology that has its place, but we have an over-reliance of it. And right now, we're cutting back on our armored forces. Right now, there is not a single armored brigade combat team in Western Europe.
Could you say that again? We have a lot of troops there, right?
They're mostly support troops. Lots of medical personnel, lots of Air Force, transportation, mechanics, administrative. But we do not have a brigade combat team armored. There's the 173rd Airborne Paratroopers at Vicenza, Italy, and that's great. But we don't have any tanks. And moreover, we're cutting back on our tank forces stateside. At the end of the day, war will always come down to the soldier with the rifle, the soldier in the tank, the soldier in the jet. And we cut back all those forces, hoping that we'll be able just to intimidate our enemies with the theory that we can blow them up with a drone with somebody flying it from Nevada. The other thing, too, is the Russians, the Chinese, have become experts in electronic warfare, which negates a lot of our technological advantage. So our drones could fly over Russia and they can turn them off, or alternatively take control over them, as happened with Iran. Iran took down RQ-70 drone, which is a stealth drone. And with the help of what I believe were Chinese and Russian military experts, they brought it down. So if they can do that from Iran, what could they do with an army and a conventional war environment?
The advantage only stands as long as you're fighting a technologically inferior enemy. That's basically what it comes down to.
And that's part of the problem, is that right now we lead on the assumption that a war with Russia would be like a war with Iraq in 1991, where we swept in, our tanks were far superior to theirs, our jets were far. I mean, one U.S. tank could destroy more Iraqi tanks than one of their brigades.
Right. They couldn't even get their planes off the runway.
And of course, Iraq had been debilitated by years of economic boycott.
Sanctions, yeah.
And not to mention the Iran-Iraq war, which drained them with 10 years of brutal back and forth trench warfare. So one of the things that we discount is the fact that the Russians are not a third world army. Let's face it, we have not fought an army on an equal footing since we fought the Chinese in Korea in 1950.
Well, when you mentioned that Eastern Europe is tank country, what does that mean?
It is flat. It is not heavily wooded. I mean, it is ideal for driving armored units because you're not restricted by roads. The problem in more mountainous terrain, and we discovered this fighting in places like Afghanistan, in a mountainous environment, you're restricted to roads. But in flat, open terrain like the Ukraine, Poland, you can just drive your tanks across the field. And that's the reason why during World War II, you saw these massive tank battles in Eastern Europe. And even in Western Europe, we didn't have quite the same, on the Western Front, the same style of tank battles that you saw in on the Eastern Front, battles like Kursk, Kharkov, where you just had large tank armies duking out because it's flat and open terrain.
Yes, I think people today may have an idea that we're just going to push a couple buttons in the next war. But do you think, Marchand, it's possible we could see major tank battles in a future war?
Absolutely. And if we do not realize that, a lot of American soldiers are going to get killed needlessly because the Russians realize this. The Russians are not afraid to go to war with the United States or with NATO because they realize, at least right now, they have a numerical advantage. We're downsizing our force. The most we can hope to do, because you can't ship tanks to the front, especially over the Atlantic overnight. Mm. We could throw a lot of reservists and guardsmen into the Minster and hope to slow them down. But for the most part, we might have significant difficulty. The other thing is we might not be able to count on all of our European allies going along with it. Again, if Russia turns off the lights, the people of Germany and France and Britain might not be quite so willing to go to war for Poland. If they open up a second front in the Pacific, I mean, we're done. That's it. Because the Chinese have a standing army of 12 million men, not to mention the ability to call up 20 million men and women every year.
A key element of conventional warfare has to do with the mobility of your army. Could you talk about how mobile our army is versus the Russians in terms of our individual soldiers or our vehicles?
Our army has become, for lack of a better term, and I mean this with no offense to the soldier whatsoever. In fact, actually, I say this out of concern for the soldier. The problem is our army has become more of a police force, more of a colonial-style army, if you will. Not to call Afghanistan or Iraq colonies, but I mean in that sort of vein that they were, it's a colonial style in so much as counterinsurgency. You're not preparing for high mobility warfare. You're preparing to be ambushed. You're preparing pet presence patrols, you know, providing security and things like that. Your concern is not, you know, going out, finding large enemy units and defeating them. Mm-hmm. So our army has become very unmobile. During the previous wars, most notably during World War II, speed was everything. During Korea, speed was everything. Even Vietnam, speed. Our vehicles were designed to be fast. So they sacrificed often armor just to make sure the vehicle could move quickly. Soldiers didn't wear as much equipment or as much gear because, well, body armor is a great idea. The fact is your soldier needs to be mobile.
Didn't Julius Caesar develop the idea that the soldier should be self-sufficient and carry his own equipment?
It actually predates Julius Caesar. It actually goes back to the famous general Marius, who came up with the idea of that every soldier would carry 70 pounds. 70 pounds of gear, which would be his armor, his food, his tent, all of it compacted into roughly 70 pounds so a soldier could be self-sufficient. Mm. But the idea, though, was that when he entered battle, most of that 70 pounds he would dump and he would just carry he would just be wearing his armor and carry his weapon and his shield. And that's a principle that stuck with most armies up until the present day, really.
So he didn't need a wagon train. He just had
that was the idea. You didn't need these long stretches of supply trains. A soldier was self-sufficient.
But the approach has changed largely because we have taken a colonizing approach, an occupying approach to all the battles that we've been in the last 15 years. It's just a matter of being there for the long haul, just outlasting the will of the people to resist you.
What would be the role of nuclear weapons or chemical and biological weapons if there was a war in Europe?
In this colonial approach, we've completely forgotten that the conventional weapons of war, chemical weapons, ballistic missiles, these are going to play a huge role. Nuclear weapons aren't. This isn't the Cold War. Nobody in their right mind would be stupid enough to drop an atomic weapon even a tactical one. As we learned from Fukushima, Chernobyl, the radiation comes back to hit us. Additionally, you drop a tactical nuke, the land becomes unoccupiable. Whereas on the other hand, chemical weapons play a huge role in conventional war. Because when you think about it, our armies right now are very cumbersome. You know, soldiers cannot carry everything they need because the soldier has his duffel bags full of all his required gear, and then he has his body armor, and then he has his sleeping gear, and he has all this stuff. So he's not very mobile. So you hit somebody like that with chemical weapons, now you're more likely to catch a large force while it can't move.
Let me just give you a hypothetical, Marchand. If Russia were to invade one of the NATO countries and the NATO treaty was invoked and we were committed, how long would it take the United States to get a significant army to Europe?
Months, because you're talking about mobilizing troops on the home front first so that they can go overseas, giving them all their gear. And as I said, our soldiers right now are not very mobile. So you can't just pick up your rucksack and go. You know, there's a long process, especially for guardsmen and reservists who do not have their body armor in their home. And you know, a lot of their gear they receive from mobilization sites or when they get to their destination, which again, for a colonial army works very well, but in conventional war doesn't work at all. That would be a great handicap. It would take us probably months to mobilize a significant force. The other thing is, again, on the subject of chemical weapons, if they decided to hit us at home. Now, if we take a look at Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, the big tornadoes that swept through the Midwest a couple of years ago, all it takes is one serious disaster and our entire emergency management system completely exhausts its capacity. If you were to hit any major American city with a ballistic missile, which, by the way, the Russians have submarines, and so do the Chinese, capable of carrying these ballistic missiles off our coast on rotational bases.
Right.
If they were to strike any one of our major cities or a couple of our major cities with chemical weapons that would either kill or debilitate potentially hundreds of thousands of people, I mean, our ability to send troops overseas would be completely negated because we would need our National Guard and our reserve here to deal with the casualties, you know, the fallout from chemical weapons or even just conventional ordnance attacks. And this is something we're not prepared for at all.
And of course, as we discussed on other shows, the American public is not at all thinking in terms that we'll ever be hit in the continental United States with an attack, since we haven't had one since the War of 1812.
Exactly. And the idea from what I've heard from a lot of people is, well, if they did that, they know we would nuke them. No, we wouldn't. There is nothing that would lead us. Even if there were Russian troops marching into Washington, we would never drop the atomic bomb. Because if we dropped the atomic bomb on Moscow, it would be a war of genocide. Because at that point, the Russians aren't going to drop the atomic bomb. Well, because if they did decide to drop the atomic bomb on us, boom, life on Earth ends because we start hitting each other with nukes. More likely than not, they would come over here and try to exterminate every living American. Realistically, no, our nuclear arsenal is not a deterrent because we would never use it, neither would they.
You're talking the domino effect of getting other countries involved. So if they did invade and when we hit Moscow, then Russia hits Britain and Israel and United States all at the same time. You know, so you're talking a multi-continent, multi-hemisphere nuclear fallout. You are talking the desolation of the planet.
There are no winners of that.
No.
Well, we certainly hope that that scenario doesn't unfold. And we also very much hope that there is no major war in Eastern Europe. But given the expansionary policy which this country has pursued since the end of the Cold War, we would be foolish not to be talking about this possibility.
If we look at history, we are running into the potential for a major war. If someone doesn't back down, we may have a major war. And if we're unprepared, a lot of people are going to get killed needlessly.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch the show at youtube.com/In Context Report. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Hello, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Canavero.
Hello.
Marchand, Europe is going to play a pivotal role in the rivalry between the United States and Russia. And before I get your thoughts on Europe, I want to give the listeners a little historical context. Modern Europe is largely the product of the two world wars of the 20th century. These wars were essentially European civil wars between the British Empire, the strongest empire in Europe following the defeat of Napoleon, and the rising German Empire. In these struggles, the United States, with its strong financial and cultural ties to England, sided with the British, and Russia joined the Anglo-American alliance out of the fear of German advances on its west. In fact, in World War II, Russia did most of the fighting against the Germans in Europe until the last year of the war. At the close of World War II, two great powers emerged, the United States, which replaced Britain, and Russia, which then led the Soviet Union. The two effectively divided Europe, with the U.S. controlling the west and Russia controlling the east. The U.S. created a military alliance called NATO, while the Russians responded with their Warsaw Pact in Eastern Europe. At the end of almost half a century of Cold War between the United States and Russia, the Soviet Union collapsed, and with it ended Russian control over Eastern Europe. The victorious United States quickly moved to expand NATO to include almost every European country, leaving Russia almost completely encircled. However, since 2000, Russia has rebuilt its military under Vladimir Putin and is now pushing back against U.S. expansionary policy. In this segment, we'll consider the critical role the Europeans might play in this new struggle between the United States and Russia. Marshawn, let's start with a recent statement by Marine Le Pen, head of France's nationalist party, the National Front, in which she sided with Russia in the Ukraine crisis. Is this a sign that Western Europe, or at least popular opinion in Western Europe, is less in sync with U.S. policy than it used to be?
Absolutely, because one of the things we have to look at is, to many in Western Europe, Putin doesn't represent the Soviet Union. To some, he does, and to some, that's what they're looking towards. But to most, he represents opposition to the United States. And we forget that we are not very popular in a lot of Western European countries, because we dragged France, Britain, Germany into Iraq, into Afghanistan, and they've spent blood, money, and in both cases, just to see the U.S. walk away, wash its hands, and see the countries devolve into civil war. So already these European countries have a very low opinion of the United States, in addition to the fact that the United States has dragged the European countries into multiple conflicts. If we include Iraq also in 1991, they've been dragged into at least three NATO conflicts, which were not in Europe. Bosnia was of European concern, but Iraq 1 and 2 and Afghanistan really, to them, we're not. So when they look at the United States, they see a country that has military bases all over their countries, and that's at its will, not at Europe's will, but at its will, at the United States' will, sending their men and women to go die in other wars and draining their economies. A lot of what Putin represents to these countries is not Russian imperialism or communism or, you know, the Soviet system. It represents opposition to the U.S. So that's why you see people like Marie Le Pen. You also see the head of the German left-wing coalition, the Bundestag, all endorsing Vladimir Putin. And what I find the most striking is, on the one hand, Marie Le Pen is right-wing. The German left-wing coalition, obviously left-wing. But both are staunch supporters of Putin, which again says to me that to Europeans, Putin represents opposition to the United States. Mm.
Did you ever see that? You ever see that picture circulating the internet where it's a picture of Russia and Eastern Europe, and then all of the NATO military bases encircling Russia, and the caption of the image says, "Russia wants war. Look how close they put their country to our military bases."
The other thing is, Europeans have a very realistic outlook for what war looks like, what the probability of war is, because they've had bombs fall in their cities. Part of the side effect of being an empire is war has been brought to their soil. So they understand the cycle. Now, that doesn't necessarily dissuade them from empire, but they understand the risk.
Right.
Whereas Americans, we live in a world where, well, yeah, we've had terrorist attacks, but nobody's bombed our cities, really, since 1812.
And Marshawn, that's particularly true of the Germans, who suffered immensely during World War II. Tremendous destruction at the hands of the Western allies and Russia. Recently, Angela Merkel was outraged to learn that U.S. spies had been eavesdropping on her phone calls. What's going on with U.S.-German relations?
The Germans have a very strong sense of dignity, and the spying campaign has told Germans that we don't view you as equals. We view you as inferiors, which is one of the reasons why, again, the head of the left-wing coalition in Germany was speaking so highly of Russia, because even under the DDR, which was the East German Socialist Republic, they had a sense of dignity. Because the Soviet Union never sent East Germans to war. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, they didn't use a coalition of Romanian, Hungarian, and East German and Polish troops. They use Russian troops. Whereas now, Germans are being sent to fight for the United States. At the end of the Cold War, the United States promised Germany reunification, equality. That's not what happened. In fact, actually, at the end of the Cold War, all these East Germans who had pensions, who had benefits, who were civil servants, all lost their benefits. And in fact, members of the German East German army, anybody below the rank of, I think it was first lieutenant, was relieved. No benefits, no pensions, just out the door.
Is there some nostalgia? Is there some nostalgia in the eastern part of Germany for the former communist state?
There is a tremendous amount of nostalgia in East Germany for the days of the Soviet Union, because to East Germans and to many Western Germans now, what the DDR represents them, the German Socialist Republic represents them, is not communism. It's not the Stasi. It's not authoritarianism. It's opposition to the United States. It's become a symbol of opposition to the United States, because the United States at the end of the Cold War promised reconciliation, no more expansion of NATO, you know, basically peace in Europe, it's over, end of history, if you will. But now, instead, what did the United States do? There was no reconciliation. The East German army, anyone above the rank of first lieutenant, was laid off. No benefits. Pensions were canceled for those who had them in many cases. All the civil servants were fired. All the police officers were fired. So, you know, a lot of people lost their livelihoods. And again, they lost full employment. There was an expansion in NATO. We dragged all of our European allies into the first Gulf War. Immediately as the Soviet Union collapsed, we dragged our European allies in. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, no East German troops were used. No Hungarian troops were used. No Romanians. No Czechs. No Poles. Whereas on the other hand, we invade Afghanistan, we dragged all these people in with us.
Speaking of the DDR, how do the formerly occupied Eastern European countries view the Russia today?
You know, we say, well, they're independent now. They hate the Russians. They hate the Soviet Union. Well, the reality is that for most of these countries, their only experience with independence was under fascists and then under communists and then democracy. And really, they've been at their poorest under the democratic system. Now, right. Because it isn't a democratic system. We didn't come in and say, you're going to have Western democracy, you know, open elections and no corruption. No, corruption ran the elections. What the post-Cold War era represents to them is corruption. Because in 1991, these countries could not wait to throw off communism. Not because things were so horrible under the Soviet Union, though they were in many cases. They were horrible, but they weren't so horrible that the people were going to revolt until the Soviet Union began to crumble and the United States and the Western countries stepped in and said, hey, you know what? Democracy. You'll all be driving Mercedes. You'll all be driving Cadillacs. You know, things will be good. Full employment, capitalism, you guys. And so they thought that what we were going to bring to them, which is what we should have brought to them, was the American dream. Poland has a history with Russia, a very hostile history. Poland occupied large swathes of Russia in the 17th century. You know, they fought many wars against Russia. Poland is unusually hostile towards Russia. Poland would accept a Nazi government. In fact, there were probably more Polish collaborators than in any other country because they so didn't like the Russians. On the other hand, though, in other Eastern European countries, not quite the same. In Romania, for example, one thing people forget is the grave of Nicolae Ceausescu, the former communist dictator, is very well maintained. Not because there are a handful of communist fanatics that go to his grave, but because people in Romania say, yeah, well, he went nuts in the end. But that was because of his evil wife, Elena. They pointed off on his wife, Elena, and she's buried somewhere else with a wooden cross, you know, in the hinterlands of Romania. But Nicolae, what they remember is his early days when they had employment, when they had, you know, they don't remember the later years when things got really bad. We thought like under Ceausescu, there was corruption. But now it's even worse. Now, you know, Romania became, after the end of the Cold War, one of the poorest countries in Western Europe. If we were thinking long term, we should have exported to them true democracy, a non-corrupted system. Then all these countries in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, would have loved us. Marshawn, things were bad under the Soviets, but not as bad as they are now.
Before we move on, I just want to ask you one last question on this subject. Will Europe follow the United States in a war with Russia the way it followed the United States in Afghanistan?
The European governments,
yes,
probably will. But one thing we forget is that European political system is different than the American political system. Our president, for lack of a better term, is more or less a king. For a short period, for 4 years, we make him a king. And if we like him that much, we'll make him a king for another 4 years. He'll decide to send weapons to a country without asking the American people. He'll go to war in countries like Libya without ever asking the American people. Whereas on the other hand, it doesn't work that way in Europe. When we wanted to bomb Syria, one of the reasons why we didn't is because the British prime minister said, I want to bomb Syria, and Parliament said, we will not give you a mandate, because the prime minister is just that. He's the head minister. He's not a king. So one of the facets that we really haven't taken into account in Eastern Europe, or Eastern and Western Europe, is that the Russians sweep into Ukraine. The Bundestag, you know, Angela Merkel might say, well, okay, United States, I might go along with you. And then the German people, feeling that their dignity has been infringed upon by U.S. spying, might say, no, we're not going to go along. And if the Bundestag says they will not sanction war, the chancellor cannot make them go to war. Sovereign nations are sovereign nations. These are not colonies. So the French, the Germans, the Dutch, the Belgians, and the Brits decide we're not going to war for Poland. They don't have to. We can do nothing to make them.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/In Context Report. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Hello, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Cadavero.
Hey.
Now, Marshawn, I'd like to take a close look at an important period in Russian history that is critical to understanding Russia's attitude towards the West today. I'm referring to the role that the West played in the Russian Civil War. Marshawn, could you please tell us first, when did the Russian Civil War take place and what brought it about?
The Russian Civil War started really in 1917-1918, arguably. The Bolshevik Revolution took place, the October Revolution, in October of 1917. Prior to that, you had the February Revolution. Now, the thing to remember here is that World War I was in its full swing at this time period. The Tsar was sending millions of young men to the front. They were being slaughtered in the hundreds of thousands. The people revolted, and you had installed in Moscow Alexander Kerensky, who was led a left-wing coalition, but nominally a Democrat. He was supported by a lot of wealthy landowners. His policy was to continue the First World War. When he tried to send the Moscow garrison to the front, the Moscow garrison revolted and shot their officers. The Bolsheviks then swept to power in October. Almost immediately afterwards, Kerensky and much of his cabinet, and indeed much of the wealthy elite of Russia, as well as the generals, many of the generals, fled. And they fled to the east of Russia, towards Siberia, towards Irkutsk. They ended up forming a coalition known as the White Russian Army. And that really was the beginning of the Civil War, the White Russian Army led by Admiral Alexander Kolchak.
And what happened to the Tsar?
The Tsar actually was still there. He was deposed. He didn't hold any power. I mean, he was under house arrest, for lack of a better term, but he was still physically there. But he became a beacon for the White Russians under Admiral Kolchak. They launched an offensive. They set up their capital in the city of Omsk in central Russia, and they launched an offensive that actually was threatening to destabilize and destroy the new Soviet government. Which, even though the Soviet government had a tremendous amount of support from the peasants and the working class, the White Russians had the support of 12 different European armies. As they closed in, the Bolsheviks executed the Tsar's family, the Tsar and his family.
This would be in July of 1918. Now, meanwhile, what had happened to Russia's participation in World War I? Well, of course, it was allied with Britain and the United States against Germany. Austro-Hungary.
Lenin's Soviet government signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with the German government, which basically surrendered to Germany whole swathes of Russian land to the German government. But Lenin came in with a promise, and his promise was all power to the Soviets, down with the imperialist wars, he put it, and down with the Tsar. And the Soviets, so our listeners understand, the Soviets were collections of workers' representatives. Every battleship, every regiment, every factory had a Soviet. So it was a representative council. So he said, all power to the Soviets, down with the war, down with the Tsar. That's why he had so much popular support amongst the peasants, amongst the factory workers, because what the Bolsheviks represented to them was an end to the war. And yeah, it was humiliating, but that was Lenin's promise, was to end the war.
So how does Western intervention come about?
Well, the collection of white Russian generals under the leadership of Admiral Kolchak appeal to the West for help. Their goal is to overthrow the Bolsheviks, reinstate the imperial government, although now that the Tsar's been shot, it's to reinstate Admiral Kolchak instate Admiral Kolchak as the new president of the Russian imperial state, and to continue the war against Germany. So to that end, they called upon the United States, Great Britain, France, and the Western European countries responded by sending troops, because Winston Churchill famously said that Bolshevism must be strangled in its cradle. This was probably the greatest social experiment since the French Revolution. Left-wing government had never been tried before. It was very threatening to much of the Western establishment. The coalition was over 100,000 troops from 12 different countries, the majority of which were Americans, French, British, and Japanese. You also had Greeks and Italians there as well. And the Republic of China took part in a small way as well. But the majority of the troops came from the United States, Britain, and France, and Japan. And these were all countries that had the most to lose by the rise of socialism. At the time in Britain, France, and America, workers' rights were probably at one of their lowest stages, which is why you saw the biggest growth of communist parties immediately following the First World War in the Western countries. So to a lot of the Western leaders, the Bolshevik Revolution represented more than just a revolution. It represented a revolution that threatened to spread and threatened to depose the ruling classes in all these countries. Additionally, it was Lenin and Trotsky's stated goal to spread the socialist revolution. And in fact, Trotsky famously said that he created the Red Army not to be an army of occupation, but to be an army to support workers' revolutions worldwide. So it was the stated goal of the Soviet Union to spread communism. So the Western powers had every reason to, as Churchill put it, strangle socialism.
Really just imperialism by another name.
Exactly. It was imperialism by another name.
The Trans-Siberian Railroad has had some role to play in this. Could you talk about that?
Nominally, it's known in the U.S. as the Siberian Expedition. General Blackjack Pershing was put in charge of the U.S. forces. His mission, nominally, was to protect the Trans-Siberian Railroad. That, in fact, was not the mission. The mission was to fight the Red Army. U.S. troops were actively killing Red Army soldiers. We were actively participating in hostilities against the Soviet Union on behalf of the white Russians. We were actively taking part in another country's civil war, as was Britain, as was France, and as was Japan.
Lenin's colleague Trotsky ends up being in charge of the Red Army, correct? What kind of commander is he?
He reemployed a lot of Tsarist officers. Additionally, he was very charismatic. He would give these stirring speeches to inspire the troops, but also he realized the importance of the Navy. They were the most highly trained. So he used the Navy strategically in battles like the Battle of Kazan to start forcing the white Russians back, breaking their lines. He also split the white Russian generals.
So ultimately, the Red Army is victorious. Was there a major battle? Why did the West give up? Or they just decided it was too much effort?
It was the Battle of Kazan. That was what broke the momentum of the white Russian army, because they had the city of Moscow in their sights, and the Battle of Kazan broke the back of the white army. It sent them retreating. The white Russians were executing communists en masse. In fact, famously, in the Battle of Kazan, they executed all the communists they could find, left them naked, and pinned to their chests their party card membership cards. That this leaves a scar on people's minds collectively, because there are photographs of this. And this was the army being backed by the West. As the white Russians are retreating, they're losing more and more sympathy because they've alienated the populace. Instead of trying to reconcile, they committed mass killings. So they're losing popular support. They're retreating. And after they lost the city of Omsk, which was their capital in central Russia, and began retreating towards Irkutsk all the way in the east, cities actually revolted and kicked out the white Russians. And the final straw was when Admiral Kolchak was executed.
Can you talk about then about the consequences to the Russian economy, the Russian people of the civil war? I have some statistics here that industrial output actually fell to 1/7 of its 1913 levels, and agricultural output fell to 1/3 of its 1913. That would be just pre-World War I levels.
Well, that's because, again, there was no idea of reconciling the Soviet Union with the West. There was no sense of, okay, we lost, let's reconcile. No, in fact, actually, the United States in many ways denied participation. We refused to exchange prisoners with the Soviets. So large numbers of American prisoners were left behind in Russia. We immediately sanctioned the Soviet Union, refused to recognize them. So did all the other Western European countries. So as a result, Russia had no trade. They had no industrial output. They had no agricultural buildup because the agriculture had largely been destroyed by the Civil War. They needed investment. They had none. And a famine actually broke out. So, and again, there are photographs and videos of this famine. And it's horrific, some of the images you see. But this left a collective scar on the Russian psyche. What they associate with the United States and the West, the famine. That is what sticks in the collective psyche. Again, the communists were bad. They were brutal. I am not painting them as good guys in this equation, but the people we backed were just as bad, if not worse.
You know, you can go back to the Mongol invasion of the 1200s, and that still has an impression on their psyche. So I suppose that the Civil War, which is less than a century ago, is still pretty fresh in their minds.
Absolutely. If you go to Atlanta, if you go to Richmond, the memory of the Civil War is very fresh. Moreover, the memory of the destruction of the war is very fresh. Yeah, the burning of Atlanta, the sacking of Richmond. And the United States is very scarred by a war which happened in the 1860s. Now, mind you, the North is not very scarred by it because the North was not leveled, but the South has a collective scar from that. So if we want to put it in the American context, we're still suffering the after effects of a war which ended 150 years ago.
And is it fair to say that then the Russians, having been invaded and suffered so much from West, see Eastern Europe perhaps as a buffer against further Western attacks?
Absolutely. Let's not forget Russia has been invaded no less than 2 times per century for the last 400 years, at least twice per century for the last 400 years. Every single generation in Russian history has their invasion. Eastern Europe to them is a buffer. America's stance and NATO's stance is not just a direct challenge, but it's bringing back those very violent memories of invasions from the Mongols to the Teutonics to the Poles to the Scandinavians to the Prussians again to, you know, all the way up to World War I, World War II. Let's not forget Napoleon. I mean, it's a non-ending cycle of invasions of the Soviet of Russia.
And I sometimes wonder if our policymakers in Washington, people like Victoria Nuland, who was so involved in the fomenting the overthrow of the Ukrainian government, whether they really have any understanding of the history of the countries that they're dealing with.
No, not at all. Because the fact is that the American leadership have a very short memory. You go to places like the South and they remember. You say the name Sherman in Atlanta, people remember it. But for most of the United States, there's a very, very, very short-term memory. And we don't understand how the Russians... I mean, most Americans are not aware that we took part in an invasion of Russia in 1920. Most people are not aware of that. Most people are not aware that there were Americans killing Russians during the Russian Civil War. So we have a very, very short memory. We don't understand how a nation can have such a long memory. The other thing is, again, the Russians are not a new people. We're a very new nation, relatively speaking. The Russians have memory that's 1,000 years old. The Germans have memory that's 2,000 years old. So do, you know, the people of France and Britain. These people have an ancient memory. Threats to their national security, ancient invasions, all the way up to the present, do leave an impact.
Well, Marchand, as always, thank you very much for your insights. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. On behalf of In Context Military Advisor Marchand McDermott Rowe, our producer Gus Cantavero, this is your host Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See you.
You've been listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/incontextreport. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org.